I'm Daniel Gross, Executive Editor of Strategy and Business. Welcome to our podcast, Talking My Book. Every 2 weeks, we sit down with authors of exciting new books on business, economics, management, globalization to have a conversation. Today, our guest is Sebastian Mallaby. Sebastian is a veteran journalist and columnist and author. He's a former Financial Times columnist. He's currently the Paul A. Volcker Senior Fellow in International Economics at the Council on Foreign Relations, which means he has to supply everybody with cigars. He's a contributing columnist at the Washington Post, the author of several books, including one about hedge funds entitled More Money Than God. His new book is The Man Who Knew, The Life and Times of Alan Greenspan. It's published by Penguin Press, and we're grateful it has brought Sebastian to our studio high above Park Avenue in Midtown Manhattan. Welcome.
Great to be here.
This is the kind of book we just don't see much of anymore. And by that, I mean a real kind of biography of a man in full, someone who's almost 90 years old. It's 600 pages or more. And it takes us from, you know, the New Deal through every financial crisis. And he kind of Zelig-like was there at a lot of these. And it's quite an achievement. How long did this book take you to write?
I first began speaking to Alan Greenspan, interviewing him in 2010 in the fall. So that's exactly 6 years ago. I'd say I spent about four of those 6 years primarily focused on this.
Now, for people of a certain age, say my age, Greenspan and the myths surrounding him, you know, the Juilliard student, the saxophonist, the libertarian, the Nixon administration official, and then almost two decades at the helm of the Fed through all the internet bubble, he's always been with us. He wrote a big memoir several years ago. Why is it important to understand his life now?
I think it's been fundamentally misunderstood until now. Essentially, I think that the two things, the political Greenspan was massively neglected. So we think of him as this technocratic geek obsessed with numbers. Actually, he was a mesmerizing politician, more Machiavelli than Milton Friedman. Second, he was way more skeptical of finance, of financial stability than people think. He did not believe in market efficiency. And that is a fundamental misapprehension that many people have. And as a result, I think we've misread the causes of 2008.
Well, you know, I followed his career. I've interviewed him, kind of grew up covering the markets in the age of Greenspan. And I always felt that he was kind of overtly political in the sense that this is a guy who worked in the Nixon administration. He was a behind-the-scenes operator. Why do people, or why have others, or the public image of him come to be seen as someone who was kind of above the fray?
Well, I think his shtick was that he was an expert. And we live now today in an age of the revolt against experts. And I think it's partly because people like Greenspan portrayed themselves as objective analysts with no political agenda, whose advice was data-driven, empirical, and not political. And actually, when you strip it all away, there was a political element to it, which somebody like you, Dan, who was reporting actively on him, would have seen. But I think most of the public did not see. The fact that we had Alan Greenspan t-shirts and dolls in the image of the chairman, and that, you know, if he was talking, he'd be on cable news, and the strapline would say, Greenspan speaks, as though no further explanation were needed of the relevance. I mean, I think that guru status spoke to this idea that he was above politics. He was a patron saint partly of the American age, but also of the empiricist sort of expert age. If you think about it, experts had been discredited on two fronts in the 1970s, the foreign policy elite by Vietnam, the economic elite by stagflation. When we get to the 90s, the Berlin Wall has fallen, and the foreign policy elite has reestablished its credentials. And on economics, the U.S. is fighting back. Suddenly, corporate America is beating Japan, the old rival. Growth is pretty much uninterrupted from the early 90s recession through to the Great Crash, you know, apart from the NASDAQ, which is a very shallow downturn. So this was a period when experts appeared to have the answers, and he was the ultimate expert.
So one of the things I find interesting is you document how here's a guy who was, you know, born in New York in the 1920s, the child of Jewish immigrants, went to NYU, was of this milieu where most of his peers and colleagues would have been into the New Deal and the Great Society and part of that whole crowd. And yet he seemed to push back against that from a young age. What was motivating him?
I think to understand the answer, you have to understand his unusual upbringing. His father had left his mother when Greenspan was only three, and his mother went off to work in a department store as a sales clerk. So there was this boy left alone in the apartment with nothing but the rather sort of distant grandparents who came from Central Eastern Europe and were from a different world. He felt also overawed by his mother, partly because she was obsessively doting on him. She was a rather glittering performer at family parties. She would sing beautifully, and he felt he couldn't compete with that, so he called himself a sideman. And so when he was a professional jazz player, that's what he was. He was the man off to the side, and that's how he felt throughout his life. And I think he differentiated himself from the crowd intellectually, whether at NYU in rejecting the New Deal, or later on in rejecting the rest of the Republican Party and cooperating much more with Democrats. He was always his own person.
Penguin Press, the publisher of The Man Who Knew, has graciously provided us with two hardcover copies of the book, which Sebastian Mallaby has signed, and we'll be giving them away. If you're interested, please send an email to gross_daniel@strategy-business.com. That's gross_daniel@strategy-business.com. Send us an email and we'll enter you in a drawing for a free copy. Now, one of the campaigns that he did join up with was the Nixon campaign, and he went to serve in the Nixon White House. But the Nixon administration was a pretty bad period for central bank independence. What went down then, and what did Greenspan learn from that?
I think the most extraordinary discovery I've made in all my research for now four books is this story, which comes in 1971, when Nixon is desperate to win the next election in 72, and he resolves to force the Federal Reserve to cut interest rates to drive up economic growth so he can be reelected. And he and his advisors retire to the presidential yacht, and they cook up this plan to smear Arthur Burns, the Fed chairman, by pretending that he's demanding a massive pay rise. They just make it up. And having smeared him in public, they got this story out through United Press International, and then the White House press spokesman refused to deny it, so it had legs. They went to Alan Greenspan, who was sort of their outside agent, and told him to go see Arthur Burns, the Fed chairman, and say to him, look, this is Washington. If you want to get on in Washington, you should sort of cooperate a bit with the White House. So having the notes from that conversation from Chuck Colson, who later went to jail for Watergate, gave me the confidence that this really was the smoking gun, that Greenspan had been involved in this plot to neuter the Fed, which is really irony of ironies, given that he later personified the institution.
So he becomes a Federal Reserve chairman in 1987, and no sooner does he take office than the stock market promptly crashes. How did he handle that?
Well, I mean, the first observation is that Greenspan, as a libertarian with roots in Ayn Rand's libertarian salon, had always preached against bailouts. And here, the Fed rescued Wall Street. It rescued the Chicago derivatives business. And so he immediately contradicted all his principles. He did it, moreover, in a way that actually let the Fed president in New York, Gerald Corrigan, take the lead, do the arm twisting of the New York banks who had to provide liquidity to the Chicago futures dealers. And so Greenspan had some plausible deniability, but when it worked, and when everyone in retrospect said this was a great idea, he captured all of the credit. So the frontline headline in the Wall Street Journal, you know, lauded Greenspan as the guy who'd done it all. The truth was not quite that clear, but what was true is that Greenspan was the best at manipulating the media.
And, he justified going against these principles, probably on the basis that this was good for the economy. Do you agree with that? That he at times dangerously conflated or wrongly conflated the markets with the real the securities markets with the real economy?
I can see why you say that, because Greenspan was obsessed with what was going on in the markets. He'd come out of a career in economic consulting in New York, where a lot of his clients were fund managers, and he very much saw the economy with financial markets at their center. On the other hand, in some ways, the biggest critique of his legacy is precisely that the danger of market bubbles was underestimated. If he had been more obsessed with markets, but in a different way, and willing to react to bubbles by popping them with interest rates, I think we would have been better off. And it was a great mistake to think that inflation was enemy number one. And so I think the problem of Greenspan and the problem of the Fed since then, because the problem has been actually made worse, is that inflation targeting is the mindset that wins, and dealing with financial imbalances takes a back seat.
And the idea, I think his mentality was you deal with the bubble, you deal with the aftermath of the bubbles. that's markets functioning, and that's sort of the genius of the American system. But we stand by here when things go wrong and when capital has been misallocated to help kind of stop some of the shocks from that from going into the mainstream economy.
Yeah, there was this doctrine of clean, not lean. Don't lean against the bubble, but clean up afterwards. And the theory was that 2000 and the crash of the tech bubble vindicated that approach because there was no really serious recession after that. Now, the reason, and I document this very carefully in my book, is that the Fed responded with such enormous monetary medicine after that 2000 shock that, of course, there wasn't a deep recession. But the effect of that extraordinary blast of low interest rates was the real estate bubble. So, in other words, people drew the wrong lesson from 2000. They thought, oh, it's okay to just clean up after a bubble because, look, we did it. Well, yeah, but you did it, but you created a new bubble in the process.
Right. So I think, you know, had Greenspan retired 2001 or 2002, I think history and people would remember him quite differently. His legacy would have been somewhat different than it is now. But the, you know, the credit bubble that followed, the housing bubble, the bank problems, was certainly much less kind to him and his legacy, in part because this happened in the sector that the Fed was, in theory, supposed to be regulating and overseeing to a degree. And it, the scale of failure in 2007 and 2008, when we literally ceased to have a functioning banking system, is a, you know, it's a black mark on the record of anybody who was in a position of authority at the time.
He went from hero to zero faster than anybody else I can think of in American life. I mean, from having been the guru, the maestro, to being the villain of the crisis. I think the interesting debate is, what was it that he got wrong? And the standard view is, look, you know, inflation was roughly on target, so monetary policy, interest rates was okay. It was on the regulation that he messed up. And I think you're alluding to that. You know, the Fed was supposed to look at mortgage finance. It had the authority to create new rules on mortgages. Why didn't it do more? Well, what I discovered in my research is that actually it did way more than people realize. In 2001, the Fed did create new rules to try to ban the most risky types of subprime mortgages. People forget this. But what happened was that the mortgage industrial complex just rooted around it. Furthermore, the surveillance of the mortgage originators, these are not banks, these are non-bank originators, the supervision of those was supposed to be done by the Fair Trade Commission, which doesn't really have any supervisors. So the Fed could make rules, that's true. And in the standard Greenspan critique, it was, so why don't you make more rules? Well, the answers are A, he did, and B, it's no good making the rules if you don't have the authority to supervise. So it's the alphabet soup of U.S. regulatory agencies that splinters power far too much that is really, I think, the deep cause of the crisis. It's politics that did us in.
So the story of the Federal Reserve is really the story of fiat money in this world. Elsewhere in Strategy and Business, we have a really interesting review by Mark Gamain about a new book by Ken Rogoff. Rogoff is the Harvard professor who co-wrote the seminal work on the financial crisis, This Time is Different. His new book is called The Curse of Cash, and it argues for getting rid of paper money in its entirety. Check out the review on strategy-business.com. Well, one of the other things he said afterwards that he's, you know, that there was a flaw in my philosophy. And I think this is a kind of very simplistic way of looking at it, but that, you know, his view was that the market should correct excesses and drive the bad actors out and that it would be somewhat efficient and it would regulate itself. And, you know, now at the age of 80, having had all this experience, he'd realized there's a flaw. What do you make of that sort of confession and what was he confessing to?
Well, one of the great revelations in my research was discovering his PhD thesis, which I did by going to speak to him repeatedly in his office. And whenever he would speak about his early intellectual development, I would notice that his eyes drifted up to a particular shelf and there was this big fat binder up there. And so I looked up there and I reckoned it must be the missing PhD, which friends of mine, reporters, had tried to get. And it had so-called disappeared from NYU library where it was supposed to be. I said to him, I'd like to see your thesis, and I looked up there myself. And in the thesis, there's this paper he wrote in 1959 about how asset bubbles are the central challenge for central banks, that markets are inherently unstable. He was an expert on how markets overshot. He built a whole view of the economy on markets overshooting. So when he said there was a flaw after the crisis, testifying in Congress, he was just basically trying to give the House inquisitor what it wanted. He wanted to actually closed down one particular strand of argument and opened up a new one where he was trying to fight back on the debate about whether he should have regulated derivatives.
So, you know, he's now been out of office for 8 or 9 years. And in the years since he retired, you've seen central banks in the U.S. and around the world go to uncharted territory. Interest rates at zero and below zero, acquiring assets, multiple rounds of quantitative easing, assuming a role in kind of economic and political life that I don't think people really imagined. What does he think of all this?
He's horrified. I mean, he views that amount of money creation as bound to create inflation at some point. Whether or not he's right about that is a different question. I don't happen to agree with him. It seems to me deflation is a bigger threat than inflation. But what's ironic about it is, of course, that I think QE would not have been conceivable without what Greenspan did himself to the authority and independence of the central bank. It was because Greenspan had created, reinvented central bankers as these sort of supermen gurus that Ben Bernanke in 2008 could walk into the president's office and say, I'm going to spend $85 billion on bailing out AIG. And then he would do the same in Congress. They'd say, well, do you have $85 billion? He said, sure, I've got a balance sheet of $800 billion. I can do whatever I want.
And so to a very real degree, we're really kind of living in the world that he helped create.
The world that Greenspan created.
Now, you've spent a lot of time with Greenspan. You know his work and the way he works intimately. Given what you know and what we saw happened, are you glad that he was not there in 2008 and that someone like Bernanke was? I personally feel like it's a really good thing that Bernanke was there and Greenspan wasn't, because Bernanke was willing to do much more.
I actually think that Greenspan would have done much the same. The reason I say that is that by the time you get to the last half of his tenure, any notion that he's going to allow financial chaos to cause trouble is gone. I mean, he's bailed everything out that happened. He begins with the 1987 crash. You know, he's bailing out Mexico. He's part of the response to the emerging market crises in 97, 98. Then the NASDAQ crashes. The Fed brokers that bailout. The economy is in the dumps around 9/11, 2001. So huge stimulus then. I mean, Greenspan was extremely activist in his use of monetary policy in supporting growth. He was not so activist in pricking bubbles. That's the problem. But I think if he'd been confronted with the Lehman Brothers crisis, he would have acted.
Okay. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have today. There is so much more in this book, The Man Who Knew, The Life and Times of Alan Greenspan. It is it's both a history of one man's life, but it's really also about the institution of the Federal Reserve and how it kind of evolved from something most people never thought of to something very front and center and in integral in our both financial and political life. And it's really a history of the, you know, the last half century of the U.S. economy. So I would recommend it to everybody. Sebastian Mallaby, thank you so much for coming in and joining us.
Great to be with you, Daniel.